The hour of 10:15, having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we get a quorum. So we'll start out with authors that are not members of the committee. I see, is Representative Peterson here?
Yes.
Representative Nornes? Let's go with Representative Peterson. And Representative Peterson, when we have a quorum, I'll move House File 263. So members, if you please take out 263, and of course we can't take any action on it. There's no amendment, so looks pretty straight up to me here. Welcome to the committee, Representative Peterson. If you could please present your bill, and when we do have a quorum, I'll be interrupting to take care of a few administrative items.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Minnesota State High School League has been a part of this program since 2006, and they've been exempt from sales tax for many, many years. Our state high school league events have been exempt. However, we still collect the sales tax, and the reason we do that is so it can go to the foundation, and then that foundation is run by the Minnesota State High School League, and the money is basically distributed back to at-need our kids that maybe wouldn't participate in athletics or other activities in our schools because they can't afford it. So I do have a couple of testifiers that can speak to this a little bit more detail. However, I just wanted to remind everyone that the league is audited every year and the foundation is a part of that process. So I know that wasn't anything that you told me to say, but that's it in a nutshell. And I do have Dave Stead here with the Minnesota State High School League, as well as Roger Aronson as well.
Okay, thank you, Representative Peterson. First of all, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of or in support of this bill? Is there anyone who wishes to testify with concerns on the bill? Does the department wish to testify on this bill? Okay, that means that we go on warp speed because you're looking like you're in pretty good shape here. Mr. Stead, some brief comments.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. As Representative Peterson said, the foundation has been established because the sales tax dollars that we pay on tickets for all of our subsection, section, and state tournaments go into the foundation. The information that I provided for you as well gives you how those funds are distributed in two different ways. The bill requires us to prioritize that the first number of dollars and our first concern will come for students who are unable to participate. And so if you'll look on the information I provided, Form A is information supplied by all of the schools based on students who are low-income students in their particular school districts. When those dollars when those numbers come up into us, we take more than half of the dollars we've received over the period of time that we collect the sales tax and distribute those dollars directly back to the schools. To date, $2.9 million has been distributed back to the member schools to help kids participate who otherwise may not be able to afford activity fees in their schools. Okay. Secondly, we have schools who apply for grants from the high school league. And those grants, examples, for example, if you take a look on the lower left-hand side of the sheet there, for AEDs, the defibrillators, student leadership programs, concussion training, which is significant now based on what's happening as far as the NFL, high schools, and the colleges as well, and then for the fine arts programs too. Those dollars have been distributed about $2.2 million, so a total to date, $5.19 million have gone directly back to our schools. On Monday, we distributed another $300,000 to the schools, so nearly $5.5 million. Our administrative cost is about 1.7% of that total, which is significantly lower than anyone else. Our goal is not to bring the dollars into the foundation and hold it and distribute the interest. Instead, we return all but about $25,000 each year, and those are the dollars that we use for administrative costs. I received nothing as far as the executive director of the foundation. We have an accountant that is paid $3,000 a year, an assistant who writes the checks, who's paid an hourly fee, and the biggest cost we have is coming from the audit that we do each year from the foundation. So I'd be happy to respond to questions that anyone may have.
Thank you, Mr. Stedman. Before we go there, I will officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order as we do have a quorum. Representative Simonson moves the minutes of March 17th, 2015. Any additions or corrections? Hearing or seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simonson.
You're welcome.
Okay, item next, I will officially move before us House File 263. Since there's no one in the audience which testify for or with concerns thereof, we will go right to member questions. Yep. Representative Loeffler.
Representative Carlson, I think, is on the list too, I hope.
Loeffler and Carlson.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and to the High School League or foundation representatives, I'm wondering whether or not your scholarships and assistance also go to equipment. I know I've heard from schools where they have a lot of low-income kids, and it's not just the fees that are a problem. It's they can't afford the shoes, the basic equipment that's expected, and for some of these sports, it can be even used a major outlay just to get sort of the basics to compete. And is that part of the grant program? I mean, that seems like if we're going to open the doors to broader opportunity, it's not just the participation fee.
Mr. Stead?
Chair, Representative, the Foundation Board has asked that capital outlay items that come from a school budget not be included as part of the Foundation grants, primarily because the language requires us to work first with those students who can't afford to be there, and so the dollars that the schools may not have available for uniforms and equipment will be funded by the dollars that go in to help them with the activity fee grants. So there's a change off there in those particular dollars. So that's what the board has looked at. I also happen to be a member of the Dunkers Club. The Dunkers meet in Minneapolis, a group of people you may have heard about them, particularly in Minneapolis and St. Paul. We've given back $130,000 to the Dunkers specifically for uniforms, equipment, those kinds of issues that schools have asked for. So to the foundation, capital outlay has not been a part of what they have given grants for.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern was more about just sort of the basics of the tennis shoes, not the school uniforms, but the kind of things that families are expected to provide that for some kids, or it's new skates if you're on the hockey, you know, potentially be in the hockey squad, but you've grown and your old ones don't fit, that sort of thing. And so I just see that, you know, I've heard that that's a barrier for many kids participating. It's not just the things that the school would provide or the admission fee to participate. It's also just the very basics that a lot of low and moderate income families are just struggling with. So that's where I'm hoping we might look a little broader.
Sure, Carl.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Chair Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, actually, I had two questions. One of them was with the equipment, but I maybe have a follow-up on that then, being that not all activities are equal in terms of cost. Representative Loeffler mentioned hockey, and as soon as she mentioned hockey, I thought of, well, what if you were in a situation and you had the potential to be a good goalie? I've got a grandson that happens to play hockey, and I talked to the father of the goalie on the team, and he had paid $2,200 for the pads.
Wow.
My point being that, you know, and we're not talking about a grant in those cases, but if you did have a low-income person, male or female, that wanted to play, be goalie, or the skates in and of themselves can be very expensive as well. So not all equipment is equal, and you mentioned capital, and so if you could explain a bit about capital and then how you handle, or how the school districts with a grant then handle the costs that may not be equal for kids that where families would normally cover those costs, but the situation is such where they can't, because it is far beyond, I think Representative Loeffler mentioned tennis shoes, but even those can be costly these days. But there is that very expensive level, and I'm a retired Minneapolis teacher. I did coach until I ran for the legislature, coached in non-revenue sports, and our equipment for the sports I was involved in was relatively minimal. But even back then, sometimes costs were a factor for some of the kids that wanted to participate. So if you could comment on those points, Mr. Chairman, and then I have another question.
Mr. Stead?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I think what most schools have been doing is to form booster clubs, or there have been booster clubs who have been formed, and those booster clubs provide significant dollars in support of a particular activity. I know there are some school districts will have a single booster club and all the different activities work together, the funds go into a pot. And then the district, because all the state requires all the monies that are being collected and expended for activities must go through the school district. So the school district will gather those funds, and then they'll make determinations about how they should be spent. So oftentimes, when you have a specific need like that, there will be grants that are being made by other status or by other entities. Shoe companies, for example, may want to provide shoes for particular schools, or school districts may choose to go and purchase them at a discounted rate as well. But booster clubs, I think, provide the majority of funding for those kinds of programs.
And
Chair Carlson?
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, as a grandpa, I am very familiar with booster clubs and fundraising and so on. But I was more interested in how the grants are handled in that respect. When I think about it, probably booster clubs aren't necessarily equal between school districts or school sites either. But be that as it may, to what extent would the grants cover if a booster club couldn't? You know, $2,200 for pads for a goalie, easily $500-$600 for skates, you know, so a booster club might be somewhat limited if they were a school site in a low-income neighborhood as to how much they could do. And so I was interested in what the grants would potentially cover.
If Mr. Stead?
If they would go to that extent or not, if you had a young man or woman that wanted to participate in one of the higher-cost sports.
Mr. Stead?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, I can't speak to the issue about what school districts would do or what the booster clubs might do, but for example, this last round of grants, because we focused primarily on the priority of making sure that dollars were available for the free and reduced or low-income students to be able to participate, and how the district handles those funds, again, would be up to the district. This last round, we had 130 schools who applied for grants, and $300,000 were distributed to those schools. That's about $2,200 a school. And it's up to the school then to use those funds based on what the grant request was for. So when we talk about goalie pads at $2,200, that's a significant number if they have other issues that they need to deal with as well. So that's why I think booster clubs and schools work pretty collaboratively to try to provide support for all the kids in their school programs.
Yeah. Chair Carl.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason I raise those questions, I'm all for kids participating at all income levels, say. I have seen situations firsthand when I was teaching where sometimes those co-curricular activities make a world of difference in terms of their attitude towards school, their academic success, and that's why it's commendable to have a goal of trying to have as many young people as possible participate. Mr. Chairman, my second question, I retired from teaching in 98, so I haven't been quite as in touch, but what is the cost of a ticket for a high school student that wants to attend one of the state tournament games?
Mr. Stead?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, we just completed the state hockey tournament. And as you know, the Big Ten tournament is coming here as well, and other tournaments are going to be in St. Paul, in Minneapolis. I noticed that a ticket for the lower level of the tournament, the college hockey tournament, was, I think, $80. If you wanted to get one in the upper level, it was about $40. Our cost for a student for two sessions, two games per session, is $11. Our cost for an adult for two sessions is $17. That's about $8.50 per game, which is about the same cost people pay during the regular season games. From a cost standpoint, and there's, I think this is public information, 10 years ago when we were at the Civic Center, I believe, or at the Excel Center, I think our total cost to be there was $340,000. This last year, our cost to be at the Excel Center was $514,000 for four days of hockey, plus the using Mariucci Arena for the consolation as well. So while our costs have gone up significantly, the cost of our tickets has remained as low as it can possibly be to be able to accommodate families who come together and want to be able to support their teams.
Okay, thank you. I was just, Mr. Chairman, curious as to what the cost was. So that's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stead, could you describe the structure of the board, the foundation board? You don't have to give names, but how many members, how they are selected, what their terms are. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because this bill is about the foundation.
Mr. Stead?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, there are 12 members on the foundation board. Those 12 people come from throughout Minnesota. Their terms are 3 years, and they can be returned then for another three-year term. So the total time they can serve on the foundation board is 6 years. They can each have two 3-year terms. Originally, they were formed by adding in representatives from the Teachers Association, from the Athletic Directors Association. Minneapolis and St. Paul each have a representative, and then ad hoc representatives were selected again from throughout the state. And then those people then who are on the board currently, there are a list of names that are provided to us from our member schools, and then the board will identify who they're remaining or who the new members will be once terms have been expired.
Chair Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Stead. And are these dollars invested so that you have a return on your on the receipt of sales tax, or aren't you allowed to do that as your foundation?
Mr. Stead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, they are invested, and we are allowed to do that. We're very careful about the investments, and we've been very successful because we're working with a company that has a lot of experience in investments. That's been a very positive thing for us as well. So the dollars that do come in do yield additional support based on the investments that we've had.
Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Peterson mentioned an audit. Do you both have both a private audit, and does the state auditor also audit the foundation, or does the state auditor just audit the high school league?
Mr. Stead.
Chair Representative Erickson, the state auditor audits the high school league. That was part of our enabling legislation when we first were formed. The foundation, because it's a separate entity from the high school league, it's not connected to, it's separate from, but the funds that come into us are expended and go back to the schools, has a separate audit with an auditing company that comes in and does a complete separate audit.
Chair Erickson.
And one last question. And when is the last time the Office of Legislative Auditor did a program audit of the high school league?
Mr. Stead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I think it was perhaps 10 years ago, although I don't recall how if that's an accurate number. But I do recall that there have been two or three audits of the high school league. All of them have been very positive on how we have operated.
Thank you.
Chair Erickson. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question on another thing, but I did want to comment that it appears our Viking Stadium is still the gift that keeps on giving, because hearing that you're paying over $500,000 a year to the St. Paul Civic Center for the hockey tournament, I recall that one of the provisions of that tax, that bill, where with every sales tax expenditure in Minneapolis I contribute, there is free use of the stadium, no charge for cleaning, no charge for ticket taking. I remember this because I tried to get a few days for my city to use it that way, since we're picking up a third of the tab and we couldn't. But I didn't realize I thought maybe you had that with other stadiums. So now I've learned something more. But my question was, you know, the reason we've had us, I think, on a 4 or 5 year review is so that we have the kind of discussion we've had today about, you know, okay, we're giving $1 million tax break to this. And so that we periodically hear, what is that money going for? Is it still serving a public purpose? And is there any other way that you can offer us that there is that sort of accountability back to the people of Minnesota in terms of oversight of how your board decides to use its money and whether that's a balanced use?
Mr. Stead.
Chair Representative Loeffler, I'd be happy to come and share this with you every time that you meet. I don't have a problem with that whatsoever. And we do publicize to every one of our member schools. We do publicize this to all of our member schools. I do area meetings around the state in the spring and the fall, and the foundation is always on the agenda. We always share the information that you see before you with all of our schools as well. I always identify the High School League website or the foundation website where people can go. And all that information is available anytime to all the schools, and we continually encourage them to go to the website and ask for the funds from the foundation. But if you'd like additional support or additional information on an annual basis or however that might be, I don't have any problem doing that whatsoever.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of like the idea of maybe them coming every 5 years or so and just giving us an update. Because I don't think there's any, it doesn't sound like there's a mechanism by which they share those results and have them reviewed by the larger public body, not just the schools that they serve. When you're reviewed by the serves, you know, it's when you're handing out the money, I'm sure you don't get a whole lot of critical feedback, and probably haven't earned any. But I just think it's nice to have this kind of every 5 years we look at it.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Any other questions for members? Representative Peterson, if you'd like to wrap it up.
Thank you. I think what's important to note is that the information is seen by the 12-member board of the Minnesota State High School League, In fact, it was one way that I found, I actually found out through the Minnesota School Boards Association that my school district was not applying for these grants, and it is all based on free and reduced lunch kids. So that is how the money is brought back, and then really the school districts have the decision on how to appropriate the money, because we always feel that those that are closest to the issue can make the best decisions for the kids. So I personally feel like the oversight is probably greater in this particular program than many, and that's why we're coming here today asking for that sunset clause to be extinguished, so that this we can continue to do great work for those at-risk kids and keep them involved in the activities that they have in their school district. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Peterson, and thank you, Mr. Stead. I will move that House File 263 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Item next, Norris. If Chair Norris could please join us. Okay, which number? The gentleman from Lyon moves House File 167, so it is before us. We have, I believe there's no amendments that I see. Thank you to the gentleman from Lyon for moving the bill. Chair Norris, please describe your bill. But first of all, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of House File 167? Is there anyone in the audience wish to testify with concerns? Does the department wish to make comments as a resource? Okay. You're lucky, Chair Norris.
Am I done?
Okay. As a resource, we're certainly welcome at any time to come forward. Okay. Please describe your bill, sir.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and committee members. It won't take very long. This bill was brought to me by actually a young farmer whose father had passed away, so he became the farmer in charge of the property, and he's done a good job over time. And this is one of those things that he thinks would really help not only him but other farmers, particularly those down in the Red River Valley west of Fergus Falls. That's flat land and more difficult to drain. This bill provides a sales tax exemption for drainage tiles used in a system to improve the productivity of the agricultural land, regardless of whether the tiles are bought by the farmer or by a contractor. The exemption does not apply to public drainage systems or to residential drainage systems. It becomes effective the end of June or 1st of July of this year if you look on this as favorable. I don't have a witness, but I do have a letter or an email that I could share with you if you allow me another minute.
Oh, certainly, okay. Mr. Chair.
All right. This comes from a gentleman from Springfield, Minnesota, who is unable to be here. And I'd like to read it. It's only a couple of paragraphs. He says, since I'm unable to be physically present at the committee meeting, I'm writing in support of House File 167, as the timing couldn't be better to lower the cost of production for the state's farmers. Now that commodity prices have dropped in half, it's become very difficult to undertake needed drainage projects. Exempting the sales tax from drainage tile would help in a small way, but every bit helps. Minnesota needs to drain marginal farmland, as the overhead per acre has risen significantly. Hence, the risk has also risen substantially. No one knows, or no one likes to see farmland underwater after extending some hard-earned capital and work on a crop. Many tile lines in Minnesota are also very old and will need to be replaced. The work needs to continue to keep up this necessary agricultural infrastructure. In the end, the investment will pay off handsomely with greater income for all who share only not only in the investment, but all the benefits. By passing the bill, you'll have done your part to encourage these investments to be made here in Minnesota. And that's from a gentleman in Springfield, Minnesota, and I think others would probably share his comments if they were here.
Thank you, Chair Norris. Questions for members? Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is a question for council, but do we know in what part of the state most of these tiles are being either replaced or installed? No, they're shaking their heads. I don't know. Maybe no one in the audience does either. I know we have some aging tile out there, but I was just curious about where most of it's done, aside from, I know Representative Norris makes a good case for the Valley. They do have issues with high water, but thank you.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I have absolutely no idea.
Well, clears that up.
I'm assuming all of you have been down in the Red River Valley at some time in your life. If you haven't, it's about as flat as you can make land, and that's one of the issues that's here. It doesn't drain very easily, so drain tile really helps to move water into the ditch where it belongs and not on the field.
You said down to the Red River Valley?
Yeah. Well, where I live, it's down.
I have to go way north to get
to Rochester. I live on the ridge, which was the beach of Lake Agassiz, and you go down into the Red River Valley from there.
Okay.
So it depends on where you're coming from.
Chair Erickson, any other questions?
You've heard the song, the down...
No, Mr. Chair, except I grew up in the Red River Valley, and often when I return to my homeland, if the water is high, it is over Interstate 29, and I'm driving in water. So their fields do really... experience high water. I'm not sure this is the right approach, but anyway.
Okay, thank you. Representative Torkelson, Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to try and be somewhat of a source of information.
A resource, yes.
I'm trying to...
We like resources.
I'm trying to elevate myself here, Mr. Chair, the level of a resource. Springfield happens to be in my district, so the letter writer is one of my constituents. Farm tiling is popular in many regions of the state of Minnesota. It's really become more popular in the Red River Valley recently because they've discovered the benefits of good drainage. There are many systems, aging systems throughout the state that are currently in process of being replaced. Tiling goes on virtually every year in many parts of the state, and farmers are utilizing it to try and make sure that their productive lands continue to be productive, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, a question. Red River Valley, you mentioned the water going to the ditches, and we've been investing a lot in what I call the holding ponds. I think they have a different term for that, but with the Capital Investment Committee, we were up touring those, and there's a lot of work going on and a lot of federal and state dollars on both the North Dakota and Minnesota side. Does that water then... go to those holding ponds? I'm just curious where it ends up going once it's in the ditches with all that construction going on.
Chair Harness?
There are watersheds, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson. There are watersheds that have created these holding areas, but a lot of the water, again, in my part of the state, simply drains into the ditches, which are quite large, and then eventually winds up in the Red River and flows north.
Yeah. Well, and
Chair Carl.
If I can do a follow-up, it gets a little bit off the tax part of it, but then I viewed pictures. I remember my daughter used to teach up in Grand Forks, and when the flood was up there, and, you know, like you describe it, the water just goes...
It's flat.
...everywhere because of its being very flat, exactly. And just curious where that water then, when it's being drained during the flood season, where it ends up going. If those tiles just go into the river's already flooded, and I was just curious if any of that water went into the holding ponds, or what was the term you used, Chair Ernest?
Mr. Chair, the watersheds have built...
Watersheds. The watersheds.
Yeah. Said.
Okay,
Mr. Chair. A number of those projects, and they're quite large. And it's a temporary place where the water can be held back and then released as it can be released. I think even some of the tiles, I'm not sure if anyone can verify that, I think they even have some control on the tiles as to if they have to hold water back, they can. There are times when there's no place for the water to go. I've seen, I've driven through the valley when all you find is a road. Otherwise, it's all water.
And Mr. Chairman, that basically that's what I was asking about. When there isn't a place for the water to go, what happens, you know, with...
It eventually does find a place to go.
Yeah, it just keeps going further out, I guess. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? I've been through Springfield. They have really good gas station food there. At that. The gentleman from Lyon, moves House File 167 be laid over possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Item next, Chair. We have, thank you, Chair Norris. We have, and we'll see what order we go in here, but Petersburg, Knobloch, Ansells. Now, of those three bills, is there anyone in the audience that has traveled over 50 miles to get here to testify on one of these bills? Pagel, you don't count. Well, you do count, but yours. Well, let's go right in order then. Representative Petersburg moves House File 532, and there are no amendments, members. Representative Petersburg moves House File 532. If you could please present your bill to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you ask me to move the bill?
Representative Petersburg moved the bill.
All right. I'll move the bill for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill. This actually is a revisit of a bill that I brought before this committee last year, and Chair Lincheski was gracious in allowing that to be heard. And it revolves around a few years ago, Farm America was audited for sales tax collection and was determined that they should have been collecting sales tax on their admissions. As a little bit of a history note, Farm America was created in 1978 by legislation as part of the biennial project and program, and it was developed through the Historical Society in order to promote and develop the opportunity for people to learn more about agriculture and about the main industry that really, I think, developed what Minnesota is today. And so they had never collected sales tax on their admissions and were unaware that they were supposed to. So we came with a bill that would allow a tax exemption or an exemption from collecting sales tax on just their admissions from 2007 forward. Whereas that was not approved and appropriated, there was $25,000 appropriated to help and awarded to the Farm America to pay for the back taxes and penalties and so forth to hold them harmless. And Farm America really appreciates that and move forward. However, a glitch has occurred back in January when I asked whether or not they came to me asking to carry this bill again. I asked if they had settled that, and they had mentioned that they were in the process of doing that, but hadn't yet. And so I said, you really need to take care of that issue. And in, I believe, their February board meeting, they did approve to go ahead and pay their back payment and so forth. But because it had started before the appropriations, it had been gone into litigation, and for some reason it's taken a while to get that cleaned up and cleared up. And I know as early as this morning, they've been talking with their attorney trying to figure out where they're at in regards to paying it. So there is a little bit of a glitch, and I know our favorite resource, Mr. Cummings, has some issue with it too, because he said it is still active on the docket, even though I know that Farm America wants to settle it and take care of it. And so I will have them talk about that in a minute. But if you'll see the revenue note or the fiscal note, you'll notice that we're not talking about a lot of dollars for the state, about $2,000 a year, but it makes a big impact to Farm America if they were trying to not increase prices to cover that. The one note that I would have is that I believe this fiscal note was done prior to my amendment of the original bill, which does not make it retroactive. It's only from this point forward for that. And so there's a 2015 fiscal note of $15,000 where it says it's effective retroactively. That's not the case. So I think that we really are only talking about $4,000 this year for the state shortage, shall we say.
Mr. Petersburg, I think you're referring to the revenue estimate. It's not
correct.
A fiscal note. Yep.
Correct. You are correct. So with that, I think I would turn it over to my two testifiers and allow them to put in what they feel is important for this particular bill, and then I have a few comments afterwards.
Okay, just to see where we're at here, we do have some members that will have questions, but we'll go to testimony first. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? And the department, I believe, would like to make comments. Okay. So let's go to the testimony, let's go to the department, and then we'll go to member questions. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association.
Welcome to committee, sir.
I'm here today in another capacity. I'm also chairman of the board for the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center, Farm America, based near Waseca, Minnesota. We are here again asking for your support to put us on an even keel with the zoo, with the state fair, with historical society, and others who share this similar exemption. We are a 501c3 charitable organization. The audit that was suggested or mentioned that we went through, we did challenge because for whatever reason they didn't view us as being educational, and essentially what we're all about is agricultural education. The litigation did go on. It was easier said than done to settle this thing, to be honest with you. It's a lot of detail involved, and they used a formula beyond the dates that were subject to the audit that created some concern with our attorney, a number of things like that. Long story short, we have been, the board has approved the settlement. We have approached the Assistant Attorney General with a settlement proposal. We haven't heard back from the Assistant Attorney General. This was several weeks ago. We asked our attorney again this morning to recontact the Assistant Attorney General so we can get this thing settled and put behind us.
Thank you. Next testifier. Are you a resource person or?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I believe everything has been covered. I'm Roger Steinkamp, the Executive Director of Farm America. And essentially, I think Mr. Zelenka has covered the essential points here.
Okay. The department, would you like to join us? And then we'll go to member questions. Welcome to the committee, sir. Can you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource this morning.
Welcome to the committee.
I spoke to Representative Petersburg last night and have been in communication with him since. I just wanted to really thank him. He's been very helpful in thinking about this and providing information. So thank you to Representative Petersburg. This bill creates a sales tax exemption for sales and tickets or admissions to a performance or events in the premises of a tax-exempt organization under Section 501c3 of the IRS Code. The way it is drafted, according to our Tax Research Division, the Department of Revenue, it is expected that Farm America is the only organization that would qualify for the exemption. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to put on the record that last year Farm America asked for amnesty in a bill similar to this. In the end, a formal amnesty was not enacted, but $25,000 was appropriated to Farm America in Chapter 312 of Session Law from the 2014 session. We're not able to offer specific comments in the pending bill because we are in litigation with Farm America on these issues. I welcome the comments of the representative of Farm America, but I'm not able to comment any further. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be a resource. We look forward to continuing the conversation through session on this bill and other important bills impacting Minnesotans.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cummings. I think what we have to do here is get the lawsuit dropped or figured out. I comment on lawsuits all the time just because I can. but, you know, and I think that Representative Petersburg was right on when he said that Chair Lanchesky is very gracious in trying to take care of this thing. I did not expect to see this group back here. I'd rather have people go to Farm America than come up here and talk about Farm America. So we got to get this thing wrapped up and figured out.
Right.
Chair Lanchesky?
Just
just to that point, I just want to say, Mr. Chair, you're being very kind, but actually, as you know, and members who weren't on the conference committee, all the conferees, you, Mr. Chair, were very helpful in this, and Representative Torkelson, and Representative Slocum, and Representative Dabney, and it was, I think, you know, we genuinely heard the concern, and I think all of us collectively tried to figure out how to not ever see them back, and here we are, but I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, because, you know, we all worked hard to reach what we thought was a solution, but thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair Lencheski. Hopefully, I mean, where's the, to maybe Mr. Zelenko, where's the lawsuit right now? Can't we just make it, like, disappear?
Mr. Chairman, we're hoping that it disappears very, very soon. We have, again, agreed to settle this. We're just going back and forth and determining what's a reasonable settlement, and that's really where it's at this point. So we're waiting to hear back from the Assistant Attorney General as we speak.
Okay, thank you. Maybe to Mr. Michael or Ms. Dalton, who did the work up on this? To Ms. Dalton, if the tax committee were to put this in the omnibus tax bill, this language, I happen to think it's appropriate language because I don't think they should be collecting sales tax. It is an educational place or institution or whatever you want to call it. So if we went ahead with this bill when there's pending litigation, we could go ahead and do this and then let the chips fall where they may on the litigation. Is that a possibility?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is certainly a possibility.
Okay. Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm Representative Petersburg. I'm sympathetic. I've got a constituent who runs a educational institution, a private college or a higher education institution, whatever. And state law says that required educational materials are exempt from sales tax, and they got hit with a $10,000 bill from revenue because they weren't charging sales tax on required educational materials and ended up having to reach an agreement with revenue to pay a significant chunk of that assessment. That, Mr. Chair, was a paid commercial for House File 89, if you'd care to hear it. But just, you know, you got to grab the opportunities when they present. I think question for Mr. Zelenka. We've been around this issue for a couple of years now. You are charging sales tax on admissions currently, correct?
Mr. Zelenka?
Or whoever.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we are. Although this last year, we actually, for the event that we normally would generate the most revenue, we actually didn't charge admissions this year. But, yes, we have. And that's what's been at dispute because the original audit was dealing with 2008 through 2010, and they used the formula basically to kind of to determine what the tax is due for these remaining years up until current. So, yes, generally that's the case.
Chair Dabney?
Yes, generally. I'll take it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. So you just didn't even charge admission?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We had a waffle feed, instead of the people.
Creative.
So that was a way to get folks on the property, and then instead of charging an additional fee, we allowed them to, for the most part, participate in the event. This is the fall fair.
Maybe we shouldn't go into too much detail right here.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, about the waffle feed.
Okay.
If I could comment, I know that.
In fact, are there other member questions? Otherwise, we'll have Representative Petersburg wrap it up here. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the comments. I think really Farm America, which was created by the legislature for this particular purpose, we're just trying to streamline and try to figure out exactly how it fits within our tax structure and so forth. And there's always misinterpretations or different interpretations of depending on who's in charge and so forth. And I think this just brings us back to more of a level playing field, in which I think the intent of the legislation to create it was intended. And so I know that the board has made every attempt now, understanding the importance of this, to get this resolved So the litigation is done, and they're not willing to fight it anymore. It's just now a matter of getting the attorneys to agree and take care of it. So I have full confidence that that will happen. And I just thank you for listening to this presentation, and I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Let's get her done. The gentleman from Lyon renews his motion to House File 532, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Item next, 1829. Chair Knobloch moves House File 1829. Are there amendments here? No amendments. First of all, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of House File 1829?
Yes.
On behalf of? Okay, why don't you come on down. And is there anyone that wishes to testify from the audience with concerns on House File 1829? Does the department wish to make comments? Okay. Chair Knobloch.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Committee members, as you know, the state's fiscal year ends on June 30th. And the state is on a cash basis. Money collected by June 30th, 2015 is revenue for this biennium. Money collected on July 1st, 2015 is money for the next biennium. The June accelerated sales tax, which is what House File 1829 is about, requires right now that retailers pay about 81% of their estimated June sales tax by June 28th, so that the money that would otherwise be due on July 20th falls into this fiscal year. Every other month, sales taxes are due on the 20th of the following month. However, in June, for certain retailers, some years ago, this provision was put into place to help balance the budget and bring the money forward 22 days so that it could be counted in this fiscal year as opposed to the next fiscal year. This is a shift that has been done a number of times in the past. It wasn't changed back by prior legislatures, and what I'm proposing with House File 1829 is that we do allow these retailers to pay their sales tax on the 20th of the following month, as they are allowed to every other month of the year. I know that, I guess I heard recently that Representative Lincheski also has a bill on this. I guess I didn't know that at the time that I introduced it, but I want to recognize her for that. And I would tell members that while this has a big initial number, $271 million to the general fund, this is basically a one-time cost. These retailers are paying $271 million 22 days earlier than they otherwise would be required to pay it. And so this isn't going to, by not doing this, it's not going to allow new programs to be put in place that would pay for, be using this $271 billion. It doesn't allow us to really build new buildings and use this $271 million. This is really just a 22-day shift, and I feel that it's unfair to retailers to be asking them to pay this estimated tax. In some cases, they might even be required to pay taxes that they actually don't owe, depending on how their estimate is done. And finally, members, I would just mention that this is something that, in the event of another budget crisis, while I wouldn't want to reverse it, it could fairly easily be reversed if we ever had to deal with something like that again. And I do have a testifier here with the Minnesota Retailers Association to also add a couple of other comments, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and thank you for that, Chair Knobloch. Before we go into that, members, on the revenue note, you'll notice a pretty big chunk of 15, but I guess I have a question for someone. Maybe Ms. Templin, maybe? You could come down a second here. Before we get into testimony, I'll get this straight in my head here. If it costs $283.9 to get it going, because you're bringing, instead of bringing it forward, you're moving it ahead, and so you don't have that on the books, we'd have to account it for 15. Why is there any cost in the future? You go to 17, it's 9.5, 9.6, 9.5 by 2019. why would, maybe I'm just missing something, or why would there be any cost at all when, if you've trued it up and you got it the way it, the legislature wants it to be, if this is passed, why would there be costs like in 17, 18, 19? Please state your name for the record and who you represent, please.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. Mr. Chair, if you the difference in the in fiscal 16, 17, 18, and 19, that is the difference between the June and July payments, and it's the growth. And if I can refer you to your revenue estimate, there is an explanation at the bottom, second to the last bullet point. In the middle of that paragraph, it states that the impact of the shift in subsequent years is calculated as the difference between the accelerated amounts forecast to be remitted in June under current law and the effect of shifting those amounts to July of the following fiscal year. So it's the difference between the June and July payments and the growth in the forecast.
Okay, I was at the top of my class, but it was an extremely small class.
No, Mr. Chair, this question gets asked every year.
Okay, Ms. Yes. Temple, we'll go offline. Maybe we could visit and you could talk real slow. And thank you, Ms. Temple. Mr. Newstead, let's get my glass. Okay, yeah, Mr. Newstead. Okay.
I'll take either of those, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Bruce Newstead. I represent the members of the Minnesota Retailers Association. As the name suggests, we're a collection of retailers across the state of Minnesota. We certainly support Representative Knobloch's bill and thank him for it, as well as Representative Lincheski. And Mr. Chair, you actually have a bill as well, House File 55. So it's a fairly popular topic this legislative session. As Representative Knobloch stated, we do have retailers that make early and estimated June sales tax payments to accommodate the state's cash flow needs. This mechanism dates back to the 1990s, and we appreciate what the committee did here actually last year to make a change in that. You actually made a change in the threshold amount from $120,000 to $250,000. So that effectively takes some of your taxpayers out of the loop there. You also made a change in the percentage from 90 down to 80.1%, which is important as well for those that are remitting those estimated early sales tax payments. So we recognize that this certainly has a large fiscal impact, although it is a one-time fiscal impact, as Representative Knobloch pointed out. We appreciate you taking a look at the percentage and the threshold as options this year as you look at changes to the tax code. Well, we have essentially done is sort of shifted the state's tax flow issues onto retailers, and we've become somewhat used to that, quite frankly, over the past few years, but we certainly would appreciate you taking a look and seeing if there's something else you can do with that this year as you look at your tax bill.
Thank you very much. And to correct the record, I was actually seventh in my class, and no, there was more than eight people in it. Okay, so that being said, any questions for Mr. Newstead or the author? Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a general question. How many more of these things have we accelerated and haven't taken care of? Because we did capital goods. What? Does anybody know that?
Ms. Dalton? Are there aware of any other bills out there that have a similar format to this?
Not Mr. Chairman, not Chair any more bills, but any more advancements in payments that we should clean up.
That we currently have. Okay, Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the only other large advancement in payment that has not been cleaned up besides the June accelerated is the fact that we've shifted all of the aid payments to local governments to the second half of the calendar year. So it moved all of the payments to a forward, the second fiscal year in their calendar year. It saved us money. And at one time, we used to pay part of the LGA before July 1, and now we pay all of it after July 1.
Chair Earhart?
Mr. Chairman, did you say all of the LGA is still hanging out there?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, about half of the LGA and county program aid and programs that are paid with those two programs are all their payments are deferred to the second half of the calendar year, which pushes them into the second.
Mr. Chairman, that's a sizable amount, too, I think.
I really don't see the revenue note on that one. Okay. Chair Earhart?
No, that's all, Mr. Chairman.
Person McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, just wondering if Ms. Dalton can give us a little history. How many times has this been legislation been brought to the Capitol?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I was actually anticipating I might get that question. The June Accelerated was first enacted at a 50% rate in 1981. It was increased in 1993 to 75%. It was reduced to 62% in 2000. It was increased, it was reenacted, it was actually supposed to go off, but then it was reenacted in 2003 at an 85% increase. It was reduced to 78% in 2006. It was increased to 90% in 2008. And most recently, it was reduced to 81.4% in 2014.
Well, Mr. McDonald.
So, Representative Nonblack, thank you again for bringing this. It substantiates my thorn in my side since I opened my business in 1988 that we had to pay this before we even collected it. Now, I always thought that was quite unfair, and it was just a thorn in a business mom-and-pop side that we had to pay this tax before we even collected it. So it's been a thorn for 26 years, I guess, since I've been in business. So I hope that we can finally repeal it and fix it for not only the National Retailers Association, but how about every other person on the American Minnesota streets that are selling mom-and-pop shops, from photography to pretzels to grocery stores or gas stations where, Sherry, you like the
gas station food.
Yeah, gas station food. So I hope that this will make it in the omnibus bill. It certainly will help cash flow for some smaller businesses as well.
Just, you know, we all define things differently. As tax chair, I define it as an effective financial planning tool. Okay, any other comments on the bill? I think we all know the bill. We've any comments from the audience at all? Okay, with that, Chair Knobloch moves House File 1829 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Mr. Newstead. Thank you, Chair Knobloch. Item next, fine piece of legislation, House File 416. Chair Ancels, if you could join us at the table, sir. There are, I don't see any amendments. And an interesting revenue note. Okay. Representative Ancels, welcome to the committee, sir, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm joined at the table with Mr. Craig Pagel, who represents the iron ore mining companies on the Iron Range. Members, this legislation reinstates an incentive from the taconite production tax paid by the mining companies, an incentive that expired in 2008. Essentially, the incentive is related to any mining company that chooses on its own to enhance the current taconite pellet by producing what is called a direct reduced iron pellet. The difference between the standard taconite pellet and a DRI pellet is iron content would go from between 60 and 65% in the conventional pellet to as high as 67% or higher in a DRI pellet, and the silica and alumina content in this DRI pellet cannot be any higher than 3%. Members, what's going on in the global iron ore and steel economy and the domestic iron and steel economy is very frightening for all of us on the Mesabi. We've seen ups and downs before, the cycles of boom and bust, but in my experience, which is, I'll just say, six decades, this appears to be long-term, severe, and bordering on a crisis. This legislation would make Minnesota pellets adaptable to the growing electric arc furnace steelmaking movement which is growing in this country, primarily in the southern states, as a replacement to the steel making capabilities and facilities that are conventionally located along the Great Lakes using the old blast furnace technology. The incentive would mean that a mining company that invests in the technology and begins producing a DRI pellet would not pay the full taconite production tax until year six of its DRI production. It would pay zero production tax in year one, zero in year two, 25% in year three, 50% in year four, 75% in year five, and it wouldn't be until year six that a company making a DRI pellet would pay the full $2.56 per long ton. And members, there's no cost of this legislation to the general fund because, as you know, the taconite production tax paid by the mining companies is in lieu of property taxes and is distributed to the six counties of Crow Wing, Aiken, Itasca, St. Louis, Cook, and Lake. There are two other provisions in this bill which are important as well. One is a much better definition of what a DRI pellet is, which I've already explained, and another provision that deals with the occupation tax, which is the state income tax that mining companies pay, a provision which will continue current law, which allows a portion of the occupation tax to be used to offset the costs of environmental permitting borne by the PCA and the DNR. And Mr. Pagel is here to explain that portion of the bill, since that was exclusively his idea.
Okay, and members, before we get to that, was there anyone, I can't remember if I went through the drill here, is there anyone that wants to testify on behalf of House File 416? Anyone with concerns? Does the department wish to make comments? Okay. Okay, so with that, members, before we get into the testimony, Mr. Pagel, tomorrow's agenda, House File 1589, House File 1590. 1589 is the policy bill from the department. 1590 is the technical bill from the department. They are H-turners. It'll be an exciting meeting tomorrow. Yes. Mr. Pagel, please identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Hi, my name is Craig Pagel, Chair. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. Thank you for letting me speak to you today. One of the concerns that we have had is, in current legislation, the PCA and DNR formed a group to do mining permits exclusively because they are, two reasons mainly. One, they're very complex and they go across the different agency lines. And two, we needed to somehow stabilize those people so that the permitting could go on, because permitting is still required whether our production goes up or down. And the additional, I don't see it in the original bill, it was added in the amended bill, would give 1.5 million or 2.5 cents a long ton, whichever is greater. We're doing that to stabilize that funding source. And I think what's important to point out, if I could very quickly, the iron mines last year in 2014, taxes and royalties paid $188 million. Now, a lot of that, as was mentioned, goes to local tax relief in lieu of property taxes. However, where the state has really helped is school trust received $58.7 million. University of Minnesota Trust received $16.7 million, almost $8.8 million. And the counties, $3 million, and general fund, $7.8 million. Essentially, helping the PCA and DNR do permits is a pretty good investment, return on the investment from the state of taking part of the occupation tax We're just hoping to stabilize that at this time. And that was the purpose.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pagel. You mentioned how much would come from a long ton. What would the difference be if it was a short ton?
About 200 pounds between the tons, though. The short and long ton, that's the difference.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ansel.
The long ton is 240 pounds larger than the American ton. So in essence, the mining companies are getting a free ride on 240 pounds per ton.
Representative Ansel, who made that up? Hmm. That sounds like a recent revenue note I've just seen on accelerated tax.
Mr. Chair, I believe since the early days of taconite, the taconite production tax, which was first talked about in the 1940s, we always computed the production tax on taconite on a long ton basis.
So a short ton is 2,000.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Dabney.
Can Representative Ansel help me with the difference between a nautical mile and a regular mile while we're reviewing long tons and tons?
Mr. Chair, Ansel? Representative Dabney, no, I can't. We have some lakes, but we don't use nautical.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question about the definition of the direct reduced ore. When we originally put this bill in, we required 75% iron content. It was then amended down to 67% iron content, which makes me a little nervous that we're getting real close to the definition of a taconite pellet. And I'm wondering if there's anybody here that's not associated with or speaking on behalf of the companies that could answer a question about the definition of DRI. I don't know if Jess Richards from the DNR would be able to answer that question or not. He's the only one I see that could possibly delve into that. But I just want to make sure that we're not getting close to the definition of a taconite pellet with this definition of DRI.
Thank you, Mr. Moline. And Mr. Pagel, please stick around. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jess Richards. I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for the DNR.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, the definition of or taconite pellet, the traditional taconite pellet, ranges in iron content from about 61% to about 65%. And I believe the definition of DRI in this case would be 67% with less than 3% of silica and alumina. And so the key here with a DRI pellet is really the silica and alumina content, because that allows the iron content to go up. So certainly, I think the former definition was 75%, I believe, is the number.
Can't recall.
But looking at this new definition, it really centers around the silica and alumina content, which is the key in the DRI pellet.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Richards, I guess that answers my question for now. I just, was a little concerned that we dropped the iron percent, and I know Representative Ansel started out his testimony by talking about how this is going to bring us to the next level of steelmaking and technology, and that's of course our goal with the legislation, is that's what we want the Iron Mining Association or the iron mining industry in northeastern Minnesota to be able to do. So I just want to make sure that we're accomplishing that with this definition of DRI, and it sounds like we are. So thanks for clearing that up.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Representative Moline. Okay, Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ansels, in that paragraph to which Representative Moline has just referred in regard to the definition, are you going to have, or do you in that part of the state have ongoing openings of plants so that, as this paragraph reads, the percentage changes as far as the calculation of the tax? Could you explain that to me? I'm kind of dumb on this issue.
Representative Ansels?
Mr. Chair, the first year, second year, third year.
And Representative Erickson, the current taconite production tax is $2.56. If a current mining company producing pellets at a current mine were to begin dedicating a portion of the ore body to a DRI pellet as opposed to a conventional taconite pellet, that portion of the production dedicated to DRI would not pay any production tax in year one and would not pay any production tax in year two and on up. It would not, that portion of the production would not pay the full taconite production tax of $2.56 until year six of the production. That's an answer as best as I can understand your question.
Chair Erickson.
Oh, Mr. Chair, that was excellent. I mean, that solved it for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I learned something questions? That I needed to know.
If not, before we lay the bill over, members, just kind of an announcement on House File 1589 and 1590, the Department of Technical Bills and Policy Bills. Generally, those are ones where we don't want a whole lot of controversial stuff. And so if you look through that tonight as you're reading through them, please take a look and see if there's some items that you think, well, that's a little bit more than technical or that's a little bit more than policy, because we want to keep those kind of clean so those can move forward. Okay. Any other questions for members? Chair Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to let you know that we did have this bill in the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee. It's a good bill. We need to do some more, give some help to the Iron Range on some of the issues that they're facing up there, and I sure hope you can include it in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Hackbarth. Any other questions? With that, Representative Ansells moves that House File 416 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Okay, with that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ansells. With that committee, thank you for your work today. I really appreciate it. Don't stop believing. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.